a longevity bonus, which is currently 1 year, to 2 years for each of those. The bill has a savings clause or in it that says that if a court was ever to find that a 2-year statute was unconstitutionally long, the length of residency would drop to 1 year for these two programs. I understand there was a concern expressed that maybe it'd be better if it dropped to 6 months at that time for the PFD so that that program could be absolutely safe. There's absolutely no question in my mind that 1 year is safe for the PFD. The difference between 6 months and 1 year, I think, was simply a political call at the time and was not really based on, I think, any particular backup. I feel really strong about that because I talked to Mr. Zobel about this issue and where the hearings were going on in House Judiciary, and he was the attorney in two of the cases that are very integral to the development of this legislation. And he said to me that on these issues, he thought that 1 year we were on very solid ground. He saw no questions at all for 1 year with the PFD. So we've constructed it so that if we did lose on the 2 years, the bill would still be useful in that we boosted the PFD to 1 year. Now, back to the real premise behind the legislation, the thought here is that to really establish bona fide residency, the 2-year period of time is going to assist the state in that function. It'll allow the state a longer period of time where they can examine the true intent of the person who has filed a claim for either of these benefit programs. And because of their uniqueness, we're faced with additional problems of enforcement. That was one of the criteria that was utilized in past cases that have dealt with durational residency. In the findings of fact, which were extensively worked over in House Judiciary Committee, we do reference a federal district court case dealt with the student loan program in Alaska, which has a 2-year residency requirement. I believe that we won that case. Mr. Zobel was the attorney in that case also. That was not appealed to a higher federal court. There's some question about whether that case is any kind of controlling precedent, but disregarding that or not, the logic that's in the case is useful to us in seeing how a court may consider these other issues. And in that, we've tried to tailor this to meet those concerns that the federal court expressed and looking at the uniqueness of the programs, the potential for abuses, because of their attractiveness, people, maybe even not so much abuses, but people who normally wouldn't think of themselves as residents may be enticed even unconsciously to think of themselves as residents and just applying what they have to try for it, right? So the 2-year residency requirement would really help hold down on that problem. The bill has significant financial advantages, but those aren't the real reasons that we think it's a good idea. We think it's a good idea because it helps the state establish the bona fide residency of the people in the program, and that's just good government.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with the goals of this legislation. I have a hard time trying to figure out whether it has enough constitutional grounds to win and what we're risking on that question. And I guess my questions are probably to Ron more than to you. I agree with where you're trying to go. I'm not sure that we can get there, and my decision on the degree of risk may be different than yours in terms of what happens, injunction, fallback, and so forth. That's where my concerns fall. So, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Have you gone through this all before? Or
I have had a committee, but not in this committee, so this is fine. There's no problem. Mr. Lawrence, if you'd identify yourself and then speak to this.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Ron Lawrence, Deputy Attorney General of the Department of Law. Senator Halford, your question is, how would I assign likelihood to outcome?
Is this, okay, let's separate it out so we have, number one, the dividend questions, number two, the longevity bonus questions, probability of winning a constitutional challenge on one, probability of winning a constitutional challenge on the other, the question of 2-year residency, 6-month residency, 1-year residency, in terms of the fallback. And then after you go through that, I've got some questions on what would happen procedurally in the event of challenge.
Okay. I think that the legal analysis that would be applied by the courts is basically going to be the same, whether we're talking about PFDs or longevity bonus, in terms of trying to identify whether or not a two-year requirement is adequate, or some, you know, whatever that period of time is. I think as soon as you go beyond 1 year, and I think Dave has acknowledged this, as soon as you go on, Representative Donnelly, as soon as you go beyond 1 year, you really get into the risks of losing, or the chances of success, depending on how you look at it, diminish. Chances of success diminish significantly. Anything beyond a year, courts have been very skeptical about, have treated with a great degree of scrutiny. But that doesn't mean that a two-year would not stand up, and I can't tell you that it wouldn't. I think the chances of having a two-year requirement for either of these programs upheld is less than 50%, but just how much less is really difficult to try to assess. I think 1 year provides a very sound basis for defending in either of these programs. When you get to 6 months, I think it's a virtual certainty that it would be upheld.
Is this under our Constitution or the federal Constitution?
I'm talking essentially under our Constitution. Although under the federal Constitution, I think under the federal Constitution, we actually have a better chance of getting the longer periods upheld. And it was under the federal Constitution that the two-year student loan program that was dealt with in the Andrus case was analyzed. That was a federal court case.
Well, I kind of remember a discussion with you several years back on a local hire bill. And the problem I had at that time, as much as, and this is even more so, this is something I would love to see happen, because I think the short duration is particularly, the rate of increase is particularly diluting and endangering the longevity bonus program more than the dividend program. I mean, when we opened that up, it's essentially doubled its recipients since we opened it up, and I think it's endangering the program pretty drastically. But the question I asked then is, and it's what's hard for me, is to stand up and swear to uphold the state constitution when we take our oath of office, and then to have the Deputy Attorney General state that there's probably less than a 50% chance that this act will be found to be constitutional. Then I'm wondering, you know, I know we have a right to push, but I get to the point where I wonder whether I'm really standing where I should be standing if I'm pushing something that we have a stated open formal opinion that it's got less than a 50-50 chance of being constitutional.
But the fact that it's less than 50% doesn't mean we would lose. It just means that I think it becomes a much more difficult case.
What would the downside, Attorney General, in terms of the, thank you, express the risk well, what is the downside? What do we risk if we embark on this venture?
There are a couple of different risks. One is the procedural hassles that all of a sudden arise, and they're hard to predict just how it would come out if the court enjoined, you know, any further action under either program until the legislature fixed this problem. I think it's an unlikely result, but it seems to me it's one that would be possible, is that the court just creates some sort of procedural hurdles that are administratively very difficult to deal with, and maybe end up tying up the payment of either of those benefits to people who are clearly entitled to it for some period of time. The other potential downside is the possibility of damages, a damage award against the state for having imposed a clearly unconstitutional law with respect to some people who otherwise should have been entitled to it. I don't see this proposal as falling into that category of situations where a court would award damages. Basically, what the courts have said is, we recognize that every now and then the legislature will enact a law that is unconstitutional, but we won't automatically award damages because someone has lost a benefit or suffered as a result of that unconstitutional law. Where the courts have said they would be willing to allow damages is where the outcome that the law is unconstitutional is clearly foreshadowed. And I don't think that taking this out to 2 years clearly foreshadows a decision by the courts that it is unconstitutional. It raises significant legal and constitutional issues, but I don't think the outcome is clearly foreshadowed. So I'm, you know, although I can't guarantee that damages would not be assessed, I think under the current state of the law with respect to damages for unconstitutional laws, I think there's a very small chance that that damages would be assessed. But that's the other potential downside.
Just the downside appears to be relatively slight in terms of the public policy benefits that would result from, you know, from this change. And moreover, I don't, when they talk about upholding the Constitution, I don't, you know, I don't think that this that has any relevance with you know, with this, you know, this issue, because we're talking, you know, we're talking about a fairly detailed and interesting interpretation of constitutional law. So we're not talking about having the Bill of Rights here.
Senator Rody, just to augment what you said, for the record, we agonized over this in Senate State Affairs. And if you call your attention to page 5, where he has the separation clauses or the saving clauses, I believe, they're drafted so very carefully that I think there's, I was convinced in Senate State Affairs that they have enough protection here that we are not jeopardizing either program if we should lose the two-year residency in a constitutional basis. I mean, and we couldn't think of any way to draft this any tighter than it is. I think he did a great job doing this. Senator Halford, are you for the questions?
Yeah. In terms of process and what happens, in the current permanent fund dividend law, the qualified applicants apply, and the amount of money available is divided by the total number of qualified applicants. And obviously, this legislation reduces the total number of qualified applicants. The distribution for those who are therefore remain qualified becomes larger and uses up all the money. And is there, I guess my question is there any potential that in representing a group of litigants, someone would file for an injunction to enjoin the distribution, saying that the money would no longer be available to make me whole if you allow this smaller class to get dividends at a higher amount? Where do I get mine if I win? What happens there?
Either one of you, that's fine.
Yeah,
Representative Don.
I think there is a potential somebody would seek an injunction at that time. If I was representing the state, I would petition the court to say, let's set aside that portion of the dividends that would be calculated if these folks were included. And we've got real good actuarial numbers about where that, how many that would be. In fact, we could actually encourage them to go ahead and submit applications. That could be worked out. Set aside that money. Go ahead and do dividends for the remaining amount. If the state was ultimately successful, it could go ahead and do a supplemental dividend to those folks from that remaining amount. If the state was unsuccessful, go ahead and issue dividends to that class of people, have them advertise in paper, have them apply for their dividends, make sure that, you know, they have plenty of opportunity to do so, and go ahead and distribute it to those people that were disenfranchised because of the law that was ruled too long.
They would have to. There have to be a showing of irreparable harm. We're talking about monetary damages, and I doubt that that can be done because the state has the money. Certainly, deep pockets can support a money judgment, and whatever rights the claimants had could be awarded to them in the event they won later on in monetary terms, which is what they're objecting to, and the court would be extremely reluctant. The chances of it are virtually non-existent because you would be punishing 10,000, you know, innocent Alaskans for the ability of one claimant to try and stop distribution. So the chances, I think, are almost zero as a matter of practice of law and jurisprudence.
Ron? I have to say I agree with both Representative Donnelly's and Senator Rody's comments in that regard. Can't predict what a court would do, but I think a court would be very careful, and I indicated that also in the earlier hearing that we had. I think a court would be very careful and very cognizant of trying to either, first off, probably not even granting an injunction because we are talking about monetary damages, but if we're willing to consider an injunction, trying to structure a mechanism by which clearly bona fide residents who are titled to these programs would not be adversely impacted while the litigation was going on.
Is there anything that And my problem with this legislation is I guess it rests on to a certain extent on the trust of the level of defense of a program that has been proposed for repeal by this administration, has been proposed for other limitations by this administration. And I'm afraid, I mean, you're trying to do something that I think is good. But I think when you make a change like this, you allow the opportunity for a legal case to in some way stop the program, collect a target of money, and possibly eventually start the destruction of the program. And I don't know how we can prevent that. I mean, one thing I think would help is if this thing is challenged, it doesn't go back to 1 year, it goes back to exactly what it is. Instead of trying three different tiers of residency, 2 year, then 1 year, then 6 months, that if this is challenged, it goes back to 6 months. Then this is an area that I just am concerned about having a belt and suspenders, I guess.
Representative Donnelly, how do you feel about that?
I think we win it 1 year. I think we win. I mean, I agree with Mr. Zobel on this one. 1 year is real safe. And I know Ron thinks we've got good grounds, and he can't give you 100% assurance, but I think our odds at 1 year are real solid, real good. And it would seem unfortunate to go back to 6 months when there doesn't seem any legal reason to go with 6 months, because it will, even if it went back to 1 year, it'd be a significant advantage for the Department of Administration in trying to assess bona fide residency on the dividend program, which you do have an awful lot of new recipients coming in that are in that 6 month window there, and it would really make it their jobs easier to decide that bona fide residency if it was a 1 year residency for the dividend program. I mean, not the dividend, but the dividend part. Yeah.
But we're risking the whole thing.
It's long.
I don't think we're risking the whole thing, because we've got the clause that'll kick it back down if it ever was to happen. And we do have the ultimate savings clause here, which is if 1 year and 6 months were no good, then it'd be whatever the court said was the longest period we could have. So we've really got solid backup.
Representative Donnelly, we have to move a lot of legislation today, and Senator Halpert does have problems with this. Would it be possible for you two to get together possibly and discuss this, and then can the committee get back together briefly tomorrow? How do you feel about that, Drew?
We can do all this tomorrow, I guess.
Well, let's. Can we make some motions here? Then, I mean, is that all right with you?
Well, sure. I'll be happy to try to work with Senator Halpert, but I don't think there's a real problem with her, Senator. I think 1 year we win for sure. I think 2 years we got to fight. We lose the fight. It kicks down to 1 year and we win.
Concerned about any scenario under which the program is stopped under an injunction because of the way it's handled legally, and we end up with it stopped long enough to lose the momentum and can turn the public to spend the money that's held. I believe that there are a lot of people that would like to do that, and yet not really are willing to go out and do that on its face. And I'm not describing any motives.
Oh yeah.
I think what you're trying to do I like. That's why it's so hard to deal with this kind of nation. I would like to get a chance to at least talk about it and try and figure it out. So that
I don't have any objections as long as we can get a quorum tomorrow.
I mean, this is
I
a
just
real significant
to
issue.
I mean, I think I left because I've looked at this thing for 2 years now and had no problem in trying to understand it. Everybody's always going to look at spooks on it and have concerns or problems.
I have no objections to getting together tomorrow, briefly.
So what's this whole loan bill some more?
Yes, just for the rest of this.
May I have a motion on House Bill 181?
Definition of one affair. I'll report out committee substitute for House Bill 181 to be sure.
Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, House Bill 181 Judiciary will be reported out of the committee with individual recommendations.
I would move and ask unanimous consent to report out Senate Bill 255 with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Without objection, Senate Bill 255 will be moved to committee with individual recommendations.
I would move and ask unanimous consent to report out committee substitute for House Bill 276 Finance Amendment with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Without objections, House Bill 276 Finance Amendment will be moved with individual recommendations.
We haven't heard 276.
Yes, ma'am. That's the Amarada Hess.
Yes, the Amarada Hess.
Mary. Okay. House Bill 34.
I'd move we pass that out of committee.
Check.
Call for the question.
Take that motion. I have a member who would like to study it overnight. I just don't think it's a problem. I think we can give him a couple hours. House Bill 188.
I move and ask unanimous consent that we report out House Bill 188 with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections to reporting on House Bill 188? Without objections, House Bill 188.
Great. I move and ask unanimous consent to report out Senate Bill 275 with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Without objection, Senate Bill 275 will be reported out with individual recommendations.
I move and ask unanimous consent to report out committee substitute for House Bill 130 Judiciary with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Without objections, House Bill 130 Judiciary will be reported out with individual recommendations.
Want me to move out the revisers
yes.
bill?
Yes, come on. We're doing this for you.
Committee substitute for House Bill 148 Judiciary with individual recommendations.
Without objections, House Bill 148 Judiciary will report out with individual recommendations, and I will be happy to stay to hear House Bill 36. Okay.
And did you do 255?
Yes,
yeah.
Ma'am.
You made no motion on 36?
No, we have to hear it. We have not heard it, sir. And I would be very happy to stay and hear the bill. And Senator Halpert, we really do need 34 if you can reach a meeting of the minds.
I just got to not have any holes.
Representative Donnelly, House Bill 36, tell me what you're doing here. I have not had a chance to study this bill, sir. I have not. So if you would proceed.
Madam Chair, House Bill 36 fills in the gaps that the legislature kind of left the last time we viewed victims' rights. It was about 4 or 5 years ago, and we made some real progress in the rights of victims of crime in the judicial process. Since that time, there's been a national study by the Department of Justice, which made substantial recommendations on how states could better protect the rights of victims of crime. This has been a 3-year process. Well, actually, it started a lot longer before that. But there was an awful lot of negotiations went into this legislation with the Department of Law, Department of Corrections, Department of Health and Social Services to reach the legislation that's before the committee today. It is supported by the governor and by all the departments. Lori Otto is here with the Department of Law to speak on behalf. I guess you have authority to speak for all the branches of government. We've managed to unify them in their position, and they support it. And it does a lot of awful basic things that I frankly am amazed we don't already do for victims. It allows victims to attend parole board hearings. They can't do that currently. It clarifies service of process on prisoners. Currently, it's very, very vague how to get service of process on anybody who's incarcerated in our correctional institutions. It would, for the first time, provide that if a person who's found guilty but insane was released from a psychiatric institute, that their victim would be notified of their release. Currently, there's no requirement, I believe, that somebody who's released from a psychiatric institute would be notified.
Senator Pierce?
You can imagine what a terrible scenario that conjures up.
Senator Pierce.
So, who would know that they'd been released, and this would be after the crime and after they went into the. Okay, let me start my question at the beginning because I've always been curious. Well, I bet you've already asked. an insanity plea, does one have to have spent any time in an asylum to use the insanity plea? Does some have to have been proven to be incapacitated before you commit the crime, or you can just use that as a way out anytime you want to?
I can answer the question.
Okay,
great. I wrote the law.
For the record, my name is Lori Otto. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law. As Representative Bromley said, I do speak for the administration in support of the bill. But basically, this bill does not affect any crimes or any substantive procedures relating to convictions or people getting out of jail. What it does is represent the philosophy that victims should be able to participate through all stages of the criminal proceeding. And so all it does is say when somebody is convicted and when they are placed in an institution, before they get out, the victim should be notified and have a chance to be able to object if there is going to be a hearing held. So it doesn't deal at all with conviction of somebody based on an insanity plea.
So it would provide that the victim, and it's the duty of the victim, Madam Chair, to provide the department with their address. The department doesn't have the duty to go out and hunt down missing victims here. So the victim needs to provide the department with the address if they want to be notified if somebody's released. So there's additional provisions that would say for matters of executive clemency that the victim would get the right to comment for the first time on proposed executive clemency actions. Also, it sets out a whole list of victims' rights during the trial. And these basically deal with, for the first time, the victim will be entitled to a written statement of what the final result of the trial was, and what if there was a sentence, what the sentence was in writing. It also sets out the victim will get notification of the dates of certain events in the procedure, and also have access to information that's available to the court that hasn't been available to the victim before in the past, that the victim could use in preparing their sentencing testimony, because under the existing law, victims do have the opportunity to give testimony at time of sentencing about the impact upon them of a particular crime. This would give them some information so they could better understand what their testimony could be at that time.
How long have you been working on this bill, sir?
About 4 years.
Has it passed the House before?
We were unable to reach agreement with the various departments of government last year, so we were unable to move very swiftly with it. We spent a lot of time working with the departments, reaching compromises.
I'm sorry. Mr. Calvert
can't
be here to get to hear this.
He's trying to get to a meeting in President Kennedy Kelly's office. That's what the problem is. I keep pulling him out. They keep pulling him back. I'm sorry.
So that's it was a major breakthrough when we reached agreement on these issues, and we hammered them out. And
the Department of Law has signed off on the bill.
All of the departments have signed off on it. And Representative Donnelly is correct. It was basically the administration that stood in the way of the bill last year. In last session, there were provisions in it that were just procedurally impossible for us to deal with. They have all been worked out, and we've worked. There have been probably 40 drafts of this bill.
Yeah.
And we've worked through the problems, and we support it wholeheartedly. The administration as a whole supports it wholeheartedly.
Okay, what happened in Senate House? Because I am the last one to know about what's going on here. So on page 6, apparently there was an amendment added. Were you there, sir? Did anybody ask you? Or what? Would you tell me what happened?
Do you want to talk
about it? Yeah, I can talk about it. In House Judiciary, Representative Martin proposed this amendment. We explained to him that it doesn't have a substantive effect.
Tell me what it is. I can't even understand the amount. I've read it about 5 times sitting here.
This bill deals with the rights of victims to participate in hearings. It provides for notice to be given to victims so that they can come to the hearing. If a mother is injured
If the victim isn't born yet, then how do you provide them notice to come to the hearing?
Precisely. If the victim isn't born, you can't give them notice.
All this today because of this?
Right. Okay. If the victim isn't born, you can't give them notice.
I understand.
If the mother is injured and the pregnancy is terminated, the mother is a victim. She's covered under one section of the bill.
Okay, Ms. Otto, what is Representative Martin's side of this? I mean, this seems very clear to me that this isn't appropriate, but what is the other side of this issue?
Well, how
did he convince Senate Hess, for heaven's sakes? They're not.
Well,
I mean, that's a cross-section committee.
Yeah. I guess, let me see if I could, I don't want to try to really make the argument, but I'll give it my best shot here. With the caveat that I'm not Representative Martin.
All right.
Representative Martin believes that since the law doesn't recognize an unborn child as an individual, then the unborn child is somehow left out.
I got it. Okay, I understand. Okay. All right. But we've lost it. Sure, go ahead.
I think it's fair to say that what Terry's trying to do, and he's attempted it in different amendments and different bills for years,
he's established
is establish in statute the right of the fetus. And he's once again trying to do it here, whether it's substantive to the bill or not, he doesn't really care.
Okay. What we went through today is a little lesson in lack of communication. Had I had the time to look at this, if we had talked, Representative Pierce wishes to make an amendment, I believe, deleting this. I think that amendment is perfectly in order without a problem. And if we can get a quorum back tomorrow when you go over your bill, I have no problems with it. She's right on this, and I apologize. I just hadn't seen it till I sat here. Nobody came to me except innuendo and rumor, so... you are right, and I am wrong on this, and I apologize.
Well, Sherry was the one who was going around, and I didn't know where she was trying to talk to people. I knew she talked to Rick, and I knew she had talked to Mike. She came back to me this morning and said she'd talked to him, but that she didn't think either one of them were going to support it.
Okay. Well, nobody talked to me, but I got a phone call from a House Republican, okay, which I conveyed to your staff, which is all just ridiculous. So anyway, we have been through, Senator Pierce is right on this today, and again, I apologize. Where are we now? We don't have a quorum, but you've also got 34 held. I have no problems with meeting anytime you get three of us together.
Do either one of, this goes on with finance, what does 34 do? I assume it has to go to finance.
Look out in the hallway and see if anybody's out there.
What does 34
do?
Anybody?
It goes to finance committee, I believe.
This made up as a CS. Okay, so it was just kind of there when the committee got there.
And
was
my
it?
Position, was there any discussion?
Yes, there was discussion, and my position all along has been that I don't think it's necessary, but I didn't think it was that big a thing.
Right, that's why I tried to convey that. See, that's all I knew, is that you said it didn't seem to be that big of a thing, so I didn't know what it was, and there's a lesson here somewhere.
There's some very polarized feelings about this whole thing, and other people feel very strongly about this language.
Okay,
it doesn't make any substantive difference to how this bill would treat victims of crime.
I don't understand that.
So to me, in the bill, it's not necessary, but it doesn't do damage to the bill.
Right. So you're willing to go along with the show.
It doesn't do damage to my purposes in this legislation. It does very much inflame emotions in a non-related issue.
Okay. Sure. All right. But that's not where I'm coming from. I don't need this. I don't need the show. Okay.
Michael's out. Maybe she might be lucky to find somebody out there. Maybe I can bring.
That's nice.
All that maybe is victims' rights.
Drag Mr. Zobel in here next meeting.
I'm for House Bill 36. We have a Hess Committee substitute. Senator Pierce, I feel that you wish to make an amendment.
And Chairman, on page 6, lines 7 through 11, which is subsection B, I move that we remove that subsection and prepare a judiciary CS for
hospital grievances. Is there any objections to deleting on page 6, subsection D on line 7 through 11? Hearing no objections, that section will be deleted. Are there any other questions? Senator Pierce.
I would move that we move Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 36 Judiciary with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Without objection, CS, Judiciary CS for House Bill 36 is moved with individual.
Is there anything left?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, we're not going to move that, right?
We'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah. I got to get this other.